are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
Well, I think it's a number of levels. I mean, one level is that Western philosophy itself hasn't been particularly good on racism and on inclusion of people of colour. So you can look at some of our sort of the greatest Western thinkers and find that actually they had pretty abhorrent views on people of colour.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Darren Chetty, teacher, writer, and researcher. Darren is currently doing his doctorate at UCL, and as well as talking about his research focus, the Philosophy for Children movement, we'll be discussing Darren's top traits found in effective teachers and examine how research has the power to silence educators' experiences.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit. You're listening to the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I'm with Darren Chetty, also known as @RapClassroom on Twitter. Darren, could you introduce yourself to listeners and tell people what you do?
Well, I mean, you've said the most important bits, I guess. I'm a teacher. I was a primary school teacher for just shy of 20 years. I'm also a writer, in as much as I write and I'm starting to have some stuff published. And I'm a researcher in that I'm still doing my doctorate at UCL Institute of Education.
So could you tell me what a typical working week looks like for you at the moment?
At the moment, the focus is very much on writing up my PhD thesis, which I've been doing for quite some time. I started whilst I was still in the classroom.
Okay.
And it's over a period of years, I've gone from primary school to teaching at university to now, in the full-on writing up.
And while we're on this, what's your focus?
So I've been researching the Philosophy for Children movement, which is something I first got involved in as a student teacher.
Right.
So, you know,
long time
about 25
ago.
Years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm still, you know, confident that there's a lot of potential in what's called P4C.
Okay.
I think there's some really good work on dialogue, on getting children to think about ideas and discuss together. But one thing I noticed was that it wasn't very good when it came to thinking about racism and multiculturalism.
Okay.
And even when I looked at the literature, there wasn't a lot on that. So I've started writing a bit on that, presenting that. And
is there anything specific in terms of that racism focus or just generic in terms of...
Well, I think it's a number of levels. I mean, one level is that Western philosophy itself hasn't been particularly good on racism and on inclusion of people of colour. So you can look at some of our sort of the greatest Western thinkers and find that actually they had pretty abhorrent views on people of colour. So that's kind of an interesting thing, and to try and trace how much of that maps into their philosophy and into the way we've started to...
Right.
We've inherited a tradition of philosophy. Then there's also just the far more practical things of who's now doing P4C, who becomes a teacher, that the teaching profile is still disproportionately white when you look at the population. And that P4C, because you have to pay for that training, is even more disproportionately white because not every teacher gets to do the training.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. You know, and you can look at leadership teams, all sorts of things. I was looking at a very... well-known conference taking place this week, and I had a little look at the keynote speakers, and I think from a first glance, having turned my radar on, I think there's probably five or six people of BAME.
And I think a few years ago there may have even been fewer. I was certainly part of a group of people who were critiquing that.
Yeah.
I even found myself getting blocked.
So there's and there's a nice Twitter movement, the BMA Network, which I help share and tweet. I think I'm going to the conference in January,
so
I'm looking forward to that.
I should see you there.
Can I take you back 40 years maybe? I'm kind of guessing your age here. What was your education like as a child?
I went to a school first in Swansea that had that sort of open plan.
Right.
I can remember the key stage, well, then the infants seemed to be a lot of playing in the afternoon. We sort of did our writing and our maths in the morning and did quite a lot of playing. Okay. And I do remember there being times when I would just pick up these, what I think were actually like IQ test books.
Okay.
Because I got sick of Lego. And I have a friend now who's like a computer whiz kid and claims that I got him into these.
Right, okay.
So I have fond memories, but I can also remember times when I thought, this is very...
What about your secondary experience?
Secondary? So I did my maths a year early and did the first ever GCSEs, so in that sort of period.
Okay.
Secondary school was a real mixed bag in terms of there being teachers who I really
connected with.
No, this was then in Cambridgeshire.
Okay.
And in Devon. We moved around a bit. So it really seemed to depend on the teachers, and there was a real variation in styles, I guess, in values in the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
When I sort of look back and pick apart how some teachers seem to be very interested in me.
Is there one significant moment that stands out in your long-term memory of a triumph in your school childhood?
A triumph?
And also, oh my God, that can't believe that happened.
Okay, so triumph would be, I guess, we had a deputy head who I think had a drama background.
Yeah.
And he was just very into sort of new media, so he was bringing video cameras in at that time.
Even 30 years ago.
Yeah. And in fact, to go to my Twitter handle, I wrote a rap. There you go, I wrote a rap, age 14. Shared it with friends. They then told the teacher, and he videoed it.
Okay.
And he just seemed to be quite interested. He'd bring in song lyrics as well as classic poetry.
Okay.
And I guess I picked up a few things from him from the way he did that.
And the negative one?
The negative one would be a teacher who didn't actually teach me lessons, but who summons me one day, claimed I'd been cheeky to another teacher, and threatened to throw me out of a window.
Okay. I can see why you haven't forgotten that one.
To this day I'm sort of trying to make sense of that. That I chose to write him a letter.
Right, okay.
Which ended up going to the head teacher.
Right. And today as well, that might go viral.
Yeah, had I escalated it, I probably would have been excluded and who knows how my life would have been.
So what made you become a teacher?
I think I had an interest in working in the community in some way, and teaching seemed a good way to do that.
And can I just shift the focus to workload? Was there any specific things that you thought exacerbated your own workload, your teacher mental health, things that you might have been asked to do? So you're a primary teacher, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they got to a point at a school I was at where we were having to submit 15 pages of planning a week.
I think that still happens in some schools.
And I just found it so frustrating because I knew, I was all for having prepared lessons and thinking about, what you're going to do. But I just didn't see how this was having any benefit for children. Okay. It just became about accountability.
And are there any pearls of wisdom you could pass on to anyone listening in terms of primary specifics? Anything that you thought worked really well and could potentially work in a different setting?
Oof, I'm not great on pearls of wisdom. I mean, obviously, I think listening to children and getting to know the class and getting to see what they bring to class as potential resources and potential knowledge that's useful.
Okay.
Which is not to say that you shouldn't recognise your own expertise, but to be able to help them make those two things connect, rather than treat them as blank slates and think that their lives are not your concern, which I think is the kind of the direction of travel in a lot of discussion on education.
This is a tough one. Could you maybe tell me what you, in your experience, would consider hallmarks of an effective teacher?
I think clarity.
Mm-hmm.
I think consistency. And I think warmth.
Yeah.
I think it's easily possible to, even when you're telling the child off, be communicating care for them. And I can remember, children sort of getting frustrated and going, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting me to say, well, I don't care either.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess reprogramming myself to say, well, I do care.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason I'm insisting you do this.
Okay.
And I think that allowed me to be boundary, but at the same time be very clear that I was coming from a position of care. And I think that constantly reflecting on that myself was important as well.
Reflection, I think, would be key. In the current dialogue with cognitive scientists, research-rich teachers, you know, you're into research yourself, and you kind of started from the classroom when you're now doing your PhD. How would you encourage a teacher to get more immersed in research, you know, with the busy nature of workload life, you know, the burden that teachers are under? What would be a starting point or a bit of advice?
I think that's a really difficult one. I think it's a really difficult one because I think what I'm seeing happen is there are kind of conduits or gatekeepers for research, but that they themselves may either be cherry-picking research or may themselves not have a big enough overview. So I think what ends up reaching your average class teacher who's doing a good job but perhaps has a family and believes that they have a right to a life elsewhere, is they're not necessarily getting a picture of education and research. So I think we're still beholden to trends.
Yeah.
We're beholden to different trends, sometimes better trends. I can certainly remember some moments where I sat through insects thinking, what on earth is this?
Can you flag one up as an example?
Well, I think some of the brain gym stuff, which of course, you know, Ben Goldacre and Tom Bennett have, I've talked about in great depth, you know, when we were, some of that stuff that was...
Yeah, learning styles.
It was pretty much folkloric, but dressed up as science.
Yeah.
And it just needed someone, and typically it was a man in a suit, would come to the primary school and say, oh, research has found, and it would be seen as rude for any of the teachers to say, can you tell me anything about that research? Mm. So we just sat there and took it.
It's interesting, because I was at school this morning, and I surveyed them on the report, What Makes Great Teaching. And again, research always, there's something to critique or counterbalance it. But this particular researcher was asking their opinions on learning styles or use of iPads or whatever it would be, and it's quite interesting because the viewpoint is always split, and I think context matters. How would I, if I was listening and I was interested in your research or racism in the classroom or in the workplace, where's a good starting point for someone to find something or to read?
So, well, for my personal work, there's my academia page. So anything that I've published that I can share publicly, I put there. And anything I can't share publicly, if people email me, I can use. I think I'll send out. I think that's within the bounds of legalities.
What book are you reading at the moment? Apart from your research, what are you reading for fun?
So right now, I'm reading a book that happens to be in my pocket. Are we allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah, well, that'll be the first time, so go for it.
Or maybe you'd like to read out the title.
Okay, Shitstorm. Okay, well, yeah, we'll swear. By Fernando...
Fernando Strigotti, I think it is, who is an Argentinian writer based in London. Now, I think you'd like this, Ross, because it's basically an analysis of how Twitter storms take place.
Right. Well, I'll definitely have to get a copy of that.
With some names that sound rather like real people, although we're assured aren't.
Right.
But how this sort of, you know, this blows up, this person writes this opinion piece, this then happens, this then happens.
Yeah, we see it all the time. I'll grab a picture of that before we go. That's what you're reading. And where can people find out more about you?
So as I say, website. Twitter, academia page, which I've got linked to my Twitter bios at Rap Classroom. There's also the Hip Hop Ed WordPress, which is written by a few of us.
Tell us a bit more about that.
So Hip Hop Ed started as a hashtag on Twitter, but looking at hip hop pedagogy, which has really got, I guess, a background since the late 80s. Of how to utilise hip-hop culture in the broader sense in educational spaces. And I think what it's been really good for in the UK is just having lots of conversations around the potential intersections and the possibilities and limitations of using hip-hop in educational spaces. So I've been running a sort of seminar series which is free, open to everyone, and there's been some really good conversations.
We'll add all these to the podcast. If you could share one pearl of wisdom to school leaders listening, where they might be steering their teachers down weeks of lesson planning or whatever it might be, any tips for people out there without hitting teachers over the head or exacerbating the workload?
It's cliched, but I still think it gets missed is about, well, what's the benefit here for the children and the community we're serving. I think that should be what drives things. But I also think there needs to be a clear articulation of what it means to be educated.
Okay.
And that sometimes that gets lost. That's a cloudy definition. Talking about whether something is good and good for what.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Who would you recommend I interview next and why?
So I would probably recommend someone who I'm writing a book with at the moment,
yeah.
which is, who I met through Hip Hop Ed, which is Jeffrey Boache, who wrote...
Boache, okay.
He wrote the book Hold Tight, which was analysis of grime, track-by-track analysis of grime. Okay. He's a secondary teacher, or he's a primary and secondary teacher at School 21.
Yes, I know.
But he's soon to take on a new headship.
Okay.
And I just think Jeffrey is... an absolute, he's the kind of person when you hear him speak about education, you think, I wish I'd had you as my teacher.
Right,
and so many people have said that.
Right. Thank you, Darren, for your time. It's lovely to meet you at long last after all these years of being on Twitter. Thank you to listeners for tuning in. You're listening to Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Tune into our normal channels, TT Kit Podcast, and thanks for listening. Thank you, Darren.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.